Welcome to the Natural Running Network Live. We are brought to you by Mio, makers of the first strapless EKG accurate heart rate monitor sports watches, and Vitargo, the energy replacement and recovery drink of intelligent endurance athletes. My name is Richard Diaz. I am your host. Are you a runner? Getting ready to do your first 5K, 10K, marathon, triathlon, Spartan race? Well, sit tight, because this is a show you just don't want to miss. I'm here with Joe Frail. He's the co-founder of Training Peaks. Of course, you have written all the Bibles. The cycling Bible, the triathlete Bible, the mountain biker Bible. It's biblical. Say hello to the audience, Joe.
Well, hi, Richard, and I appreciate your having me on today. The books I've written have been kind of biblical sounding, but that's just the way I look at the world, I guess.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm going to get some flack from somebody for saying what I said, but whatever. But so the book we're going to talk about that you just released, I'm assuming this is available for sale already, right?
Yeah, it came out in December.
Okay, cool. So the title of this book is Fast After 50, How to Race Strong for the Rest of Your Life. Now, needless to say, being above 50, this is definitely a book that resonates very well with me. And I have to tell you, Joe, when I started reading it, like the first, this is the perfect way to write a book, because first you depress me, and then you bring me back up again, right? So we're going to talk about all the terrible things that happen when you start to get old, and the proof behind it, scientific evidence that indicates that all these things are going to happen whether you like it or not, and then there's hope. So let's start this by why don't you give us the broad stroke of why? I mean, I kind of know, because we talked about it last time we talked, but let's let the audience know what led you to write this book.
Sure. Yeah, it was the summer of 2012, and I was anticipating my 70th birthday at the end of the year. I'm sorry, summer of 2013. I was anticipating my birthday in December. And I'd been thinking about the next birthday for quite a long time, because that was 70. Somehow 70 got my attention. 50 never did. 60 never really got my attention either. But 70 got my attention, because back in the late 90s, I'd written a book called Cycling Past 50. And at the time, I'd read most of all the research I could find on the subject of older athletes. There wasn't much then, research that is. And what I found was that the only thing I found that was really interesting was that as you get north of 70, performance began to decline at a more rapid rate than it did south of 70. So this birthday coming up got my attention. And so I decided to give myself a birthday present early that summer, and decided I was going to read all the research I could find on the subject, and just to see what had come out since I'd last read on that topic back in the late 1990s. And so there's a tremendous amount of research that came out in those intervening years. So I started reading it, and basically for the next 8 months, I read at least one research study every day for 8 months. And I still didn't read all of it, but I read the most pertinent stuff. And I began to write my blog on my blog about what I was discovering. And I got such great responses from my readers, especially the older readers, that I decided a book must be necessary for this. There really wasn't anything out there that did what I was doing, which was discuss training for aging athletes from a scientific perspective. And so that's how the book came to be.
Oh, cool. Okay, so the relevance of the research of late compared to what you were reading in the 90s, did you notice much change in the trends in respect to what we thought was going to happen to us and what's actually happening to us?
Not really, because there was so little information available back then that it was hard to see any trends. There were comments about things in some of the research, you know, the more recent, basically what happens in this kind of research is at the end, the scientists say something like more research is necessary in this, on this topic, because there just wasn't enough around. So there really wasn't much to hang your hat on. And so what I was reading here the summer of 2013, in fact, the rest of the year of 2013 and into 2014, was basically stuff that was really new. You know, it had only been around for, by that time, roughly about 10 years. So really no trends earlier than just because there wasn't much research to show trends.
Okay, so the good news is, and I guess that's kind of what resonates throughout the book, is that if we stay active, if we try to keep exercising, and you know, just not just get out there and go for a walk, but you know, get some vigorous exercise, things are going to be a lot more promising for us. And I'm looking at this chapter in the very beginning of the book where they do this comparison of mice and men, and right. where in the book you show the study they did on these mice where. I guess the one mice was put on a pretty serious regimen of running of about 50 minutes or so, three times a week, yeah. And then compared it, and apparently, you know, relative to the lifespan of a mouse compared to us, it looks like a mouse being about 8 months old would be roughly 60 years old in humans, right?
Right, that's right.
So what was interesting about this that I thought is you have a picture of both of these mice, one that was sedentary and one that was exercising, and there's a real noticeable difference in the appearance of the, you know, the aging of the two, or one
sure.
being, you know, the one that was sedentary looks far older than the one that was, you know, getting the exercise, completely
yeah.
different. So. I could almost draw some parallels between friends, and given that yesterday was Super Bowl, you know, I met with some folks and we had a little fun and there was a couple guys there. It was kind of interesting, you know, because a couple of the guys, actually I was the oldest guy in the room, which I hate to always be, but so here comes a guy and he's making his way to the front door and he's hobbling, you know, his knees jacked up. And he told me that he goes, I had a cortisone shot in my knee. And so, you know, I'm on Vicodin for the pain. And then I had to take something to settle my stomach. And now my stomach's irritated. And I need to go sit down for a little bit. I mean, the guy was going through I'm thinking the guy is 10 years younger than me. And his knee issue is not because he'd been running on it or riding his bike. He's just pretty much one of those guys. He's a desk jockey and falling apart, you know? And what was interesting is the day before that, not to go on this rant, but just I'm comparing mice here. A day before that, a group of us went into the Santa Monica Mountains to do a little bit of hill work and on foot. And there's a paved road that drops you into the canyon where we go, which is about a mile long, and it's pretty steep. And one of my clients that was with me picked up this great big rock and decided to carry the rock up the hill. Well, you know, of course, I couldn't be outdone by that, so I had to find a bigger rock. And we both made our way out of the canyon with these big boulders on our shoulder. And so it was a Kodak moment. Somebody took a picture, and so that was the topic of discussion pre Super Bowl was us going out of the canyon with these boulders on our shoulders while this guy was hobbling around with a knee that really didn't face any activity. I guess there goes the proof in the pudding, right? If we stay busy, we're going to stay upright a little bit longer.
Yeah, the fellow that limped up to the door with a bad knee, I really didn't know what the situation was, obviously, but Jack LaLanne had remember him?
Yeah.
Jack LaLanne, he had an interesting comment about that sort of thing. He says it's much better to wear out than to rust out. I don't know, again, don't know what the fellow was to cause his knee problem, but for many people, when they get into the past age 50 that don't exercise, they're basically rusting out. They're not wearing out.
Right. Well, that's a really interesting point. By the way, I've met Jack LaLanne. He was a character, I should say.
Yes.
And if you bump into him, if you've ever met him, I guarantee you, with inside of 5 minutes of having talked to him, he's gonna be on the ground doing push-ups on his fingertips.
Yeah, okay.
That's what he would do. Hi, my name's Jack, and he'd be on the ground and popping out these fingertip push-ups, one-arm push-ups, just so you could do it. And I don't know how old he was back then, but it wasn't too much longer after he pulled that barge with his teeth from Alcatraz, handcuffed. So getting back to your book, I thought it was kind of interesting that we're taking a step in the direction of how to care for ourselves and how to approach our training, because I think, and obviously you know, but I think that the trend for people when they get older is they shy away from high intensity exercise because they assume that they need to do things that are more gentle on their body. And then they opt for, you know, low intensity cardiovascular exercise and little to any strength training. So your book is basically the polar opposite of that. So can you kind of go off on this rant about, you know, the need for this intensity and what the importance of it is?
Sure. Yeah, what the research says is that there are three reasons that we slow down. In fact, it was overwhelming how much research basically said the same thing. Two of those reasons have to do with how one trains. Two reasons are decrease in aerobic capacity, which is also called VO2 max, and the decline in muscle mass as we get older. And both of these things are related to essentially how vigorously one exercises. The tendency as we get older, you're exactly right. The tendency is that we tend to move toward long, slow distance. We tend to make everything easy, and we become very concerned about how long the workout is and how many miles we do in a week as opposed to how intensely we may have trained any time during the week. And the research basically tells us it's just the opposite. As you get older, the concern has to be how intense your exercise is. In fact, the book goes through several research studies which show that without a doubt. Longitudinal studies, which are the gold standard. One case, the study was 20 years old, or 20 years. They studied the same athletes from the time they were younger athletes until they were well beyond age 50. And they found that those who kept on doing high-intensity training, intervals and races and so forth, continued to keep their VO2 max at a very high level, or almost no decline at all, less than 0.5% per year. Whereas the athletes who went to long, slow distance lost more than 1% per year of aerobic capacity. And those who stopped exercising altogether lost about 1.5% per year of aerobic capacity. So it became clear as I read the research that intensity really is the key to this. The problem for most athletes is that they're very concerned about two things. Number one, and the biggest thing, is injury, especially runners. They've been injured a number of times. In fact, you become more likely to be injured the older you get. And so consequently, they shy away from doing anything that's high intensity because it puts more stress on joints and muscles, tendons, and so forth. And but the problem is, I think, not so much the high intensity, but rather greed. Athletes, when they decide to get in better shape, decide to do it overnight. And so they bite off more than they can actually manage. In the book, I talk about dose and density. The dose is how big is the workout. If you get injured, it's because either the dose was too big, you tried to make the workout too hard, or number two, the density of the workout was too great. Density means how close together the hard workouts are.
Right.
And so that becomes the key to avoiding injury and overtraining. Is to get the dose and density right. And so I give examples of how to get that right from the starting position. If you've not been doing intervals for a long time, if you've not been doing high intensity training, if you've not been doing weightlifting with high loads, low reps for a long time, how to get back into it without getting injured again, because the body will adapt. That's the beautiful thing about the body, is it adapts very, very nicely if you're kind to it. If you try to make it move quickly and adapt to a schedule that's not natural, it will rebel and you'll have an injury of some sort. So it's not the injury that's the problem, it's the greed that's the problem. That's what the athlete needs to avoid.
Yeah. So I can tell you my own experience, just to share with you, last year I trained up to do another triathlon, which, you know, I thought was pretty much off my radar for, you know, for my life. But
yeah.
I sucked it up, and what led me to it was I started to find my fitness on my bike, where I was losing my fitness running. And I just found that as I get older, I get heavier, and the return to the road running was harsh for me. I just found that it just the workouts were just too debilitating to put together back to back on a regular sequence. But riding, I got away with a lot more. Obviously enough, because it's less stressful to the joints, especially being on the bike properly. But I went through a stage where getting out of the saddle and climbing, my knees hurt. And and then what was interesting about that was you got two decisions you could make. You could decide that your knees can't take it, or you just try to find a way to get past it. And what I found was pretty quickly my strength started coming together, and I became more and more proficient, and my knees bothered me less. And the more intensity I was able to take on, the less my knees were bothering me. And I actually got back to running better because of the strength component that I developed on the bike. Because I also found that I can push my heart a lot harder on the bike than I could running. So what I started noticing is that my runs turned out to be really low intensity, low aerobic workouts, where my running or my cycling capacity was where I could go hard. But they started to complement one another. So, I don't want to get off on a tangent on this, but just my own experience was that, I think a lot of guys, what happens is they start getting crickety, like you're suggesting the rust. They start to rust a little bit, and their assumption is that it's over, and then they tend to want to back away rather than to charge ahead. And, I mean, obviously enough, you need to be, cautious, but I think that there's definitely something to be said for being tenacious and trying to get through to the other side, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, certainly what you've experienced is common for a lot of athletes. In fact, one thing I suggest in the book is if runners who really have more difficulty probably with injuries than most other endurance sports, if they can't seem to get it together at all with doing high-intensity training because of, like, knee injuries, like you mentioned, but sometimes going to the bike is beneficial even for the running fitness. In fact, some research that seems to support that doing intervals on the bike transfers to running fitness also. So there may be a reason to do exactly what you said you did.
Well, I could tell you that it helped me a lot. And I noticed that my ability to run improved. And, my day job is working with people to improve their running mechanics. And I think that's a principal component of the ability to sustain greater intensities running, is just getting in the right place and not butchering yourself as you're trying to go down the road. So absolutely, all this kind of goes hand in hand. But I also I thought it was interesting, the comment you made and the terms you use in your book in respect to dose and density. I think it's a pretty interesting look, because obviously the greater the dose, the less density you're going to need or want, right? And
yeah,
opposite
right.
being too true as well. So
right.
I know, I don't know what the script is for most people, but generally if I do something pretty intense, I need about 2 days on average to come back. I can't throw big workouts back to back anymore, day after day. I need some time. Now, I could do some low intensity stuff every day, but if I put a big workout together, there's some repayment that's necessary.
Yeah. In fact, that's one of the things I suggest in the book, is that one of the problems that we have as we get older is we don't recover as quickly as we did when we were young. So anything that's high dose requires more time to recover from than it did 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so one thing I suggest in the book is that the athlete, instead of training on a 7-day schedule, train on a 9-day schedule if that's possible. One of the problems is if you have a job and you have to do a long run on a Tuesday morning because it's a 9-day schedule, you may not be able to get it done. So it doesn't work for everybody, but some people have a flexible lifestyle or they're retired. And because of that, they can go to a 9-day week, if you want to call it a week. And then what they do is they have 2 days of recovery after every high-dose workout. So if you do one of these high-intensity interval workouts that I'm describing on Monday, you would have Tuesday and Wednesday to recover. And then on Thursday, you go back to another high-intensity type of workout. So that, so I built it into the schedule by going to a different way of looking at what a week is.
So just to be clear, when you talk about a 9-day schedule, I'm assuming that it's cyclical. So you're tapping in a couple days worth of recovery, and then you go back into the session and repeat it. Maybe some variable changes, but for the most part, it's a sequence of 9 days where there's a measured amount of work and a measured amount of recovery over those time frames. Right.
That's right. Yeah. The idea is that. Is that we're going to spread the workouts out, so we're going to decrease the density from what you might be doing within a 7-day week. 7-day week doesn't work very well for most athletes when you've got to have 2 days recovery, because that means you only get every 2 days or every week, you only get two quality workouts in. Whereas, so over the course of 2 weeks, you only get 4. Whereas if you change it to a 9-day schedule, now every third day, we get a harder workout in, so we manage to fit in another workout every 2 weeks than we would with a 7-day schedule. So it just becomes cyclical, as you mentioned. So we train 9 days, and then we start the next 9-day cycle. At the end of that 9-day cycle, which is now 18 days, we take a couple of days to recover, you know, more days to recover, so like 3 days to recover now instead of only 2, or perhaps even 5 days for some athletes who need even more time. So we take a longer time to recover just to get that periodic longer break from hard training before we start into the next cycle. And we simply refer to these as mesocycles. And right. If anybody's ever read any of my Bibles that you've mentioned a while ago, they'll find discussions in there of how to set up mesocycles, which are several week long periods of training.
Right. So you essentially it's a periodized approach to work where you're making sure that the recovery is an integral component of the process, right?
Exactly.
And
right.
Assuming that, you know, as the volume and the intensity starts to build, that more recovery is going to be required as you get deeper into the work.
Yeah, certainly. So that's the reason we take 2 days after every high dose workout. So we spread out, we decrease the density. And then at the end of roughly about 3 weeks, rough around that time, 18 to 20 days, now we take an extended period of recovery, another 2 to even 5 days, depending on the athlete, what they need. So we could take a longer break from training, so we'll recover even more fully than we start in the next cycle of 18 days.
Right. You know, it's interesting that we're having this conversation today, because I'm meeting with an athlete tomorrow who is a Spartan racer. He's an elite pro, and he's got a big schedule over the next 7 or 8 months. Where he's involved in some television program that they're doing, and he's got some adventure racing he has to do. He's got some mountain bike challenges. He's got a couple of ultra runs he has to do, and just a whole passel of challenges he's going to face every month in different parts of the world. And we're going to try to help him periodize this work in such a way that you know, he's going to be in the right place at the right time physically with each of these different events. And it's kind of challenging because they're doing it for television. They're not doing it for sport. They're not trying to see if they can achieve a competitive peak. They're just throwing stuff at them that they might think is entertaining for people to watch on television, right? So he's basically the Raggedy Andy that's going to get smacked around, and hopefully he'll survive. And if he doesn't, it makes for better TV. So we're trying to figure out what the, you know, what samplings of work he should do, and now even though he's much younger than 50, I think this approach that you have with this 9-day training week is interesting, because what he doesn't get a lot of is recovery. He tends to not want to recover, which is probably common with a lot of young guys, right? They don't take the recovery time.
It's common with a lot of athletes, actually. They try to pack way too much high intensity, and the density becomes too great. And because of that, they break down. Eventually, it's injury or it's just significant fatigue. The early stages of overtraining or illness, something interferes with continuation of that way of training.
So another thing that I found pretty fascinating in your book, and it was very timely, is that you spend a lot of energy on nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
And you drew some parallels, which is interesting because this is the kind of stuff that hasn't been talked about a lot, but is being talked about a lot now, which is the decision to be a carbohydrate running engine or a fat-adapted running engine. And we actually discussed this on a show a couple weeks back because I work with a lot of these guys that are doing these Spartan races, and they tend to do some pretty crazy challenges. And, you know, they go long. And there's a lot of guys from the ultra marathon community that are very involved in this high fat, low carb diets. And so I like how you did it, kind of a comparative. You just kind of said, well, if you're going to be this guy, this is kind of how you would traditionally feed. And if you're going to be this guy, this is how you should be feeding and how that kind of works. So I want to ask you, because you didn't point in either direction. You didn't say, this is what I think you should do, or that's what I think you should do. You just kind of shed some light on both of those scenarios. So my question to you is, let's say that I'm a 25-year-old athlete, and I come to you, and, you know, there's not been much rhyme or reason to my nutrition other than I'm trying to stay wholesome. I'm trying to, you know, have a holistic lifestyle. I don't eat a lot of junk food. But I eat when I'm hungry, and I just obviously an eating machine because I'm exercising all the time. To encourage increases in performance, would you lend someone towards a high-fat diet?
Not necessarily. It depends on the athlete. I think it works best with someone who is what's called carbohydrate resistant or insulin resistant. Typically, what that person has experienced is they gain weight, especially body fat, very easily, and they have a hard time getting rid of it. You know, they may cut calories and they still can't shed the excess weight. And so that sort of person probably needs to really strongly consider going to a low-carb diet, high-fat, instead of what they've been doing, which has probably been high-carbohydrate, which is pretty much the standard across the board for athletes. But if the athlete is doing well, training well, no illness, recovering well from hard workouts and so forth, everything is good, then I would see no reason to change the diet. So, but what the athlete needs to keep in mind is what is your situation, your condition in those regards at age 25 is not necessarily going to be the same thing that it is at age 35, 45, 55, and so forth. So, you know, the person needs to keep an open mind that there are possibilities of things changing. As we get older, we tend to think it's not, that somehow I'm going to remain skinny all my life and perform at this high level. But you start getting older and you realize, gosh, something's different here. I'm putting on belly fat and slowing down. All this stuff is happening. So that person's just arrived at the point where they need to reconsider their nutrition.
It just seems like such a contradiction to lean towards a higher fat diet when your tendency is to gain weight, you know? I get what you're saying. Is you're saying that, you know, maybe you're insulin sensitive and you have some issues that are not allowing you to metabolize well. But just the density in calories relative to someone that, I mean, you could essentially, I mean, obviously now fat is not as dense of a food substance as carbohydrate. You know, if you were to be a vegan and you want to eat 5,000 calories of carbohydrate, you got a lot of eating to do, right? As opposed to eating high fat. So I don't know. It's just really something that seems to be high on everybody's list to think about right now. And what I liked about what you said in here was that you really can't trip back and forth between these two processes. You either got to go one way or you got to go the other, and then you got to stick it out, right?
Yeah, stick it out until you discover somehow it's not working. That's the other alternative is it may not work for you. For some person may try going to a low carb, high fat diet and stick with it for several weeks, maybe even months, and discover they're really still gaining weight and they can't get rid of the excess weight, they're not performing well, they're not recovering well, whatever the situation may be. And so that is not, something is wrong, perhaps, with their diet. There's so many things that are going on, it's hard to really draw conclusions. That's just one of the possibilities it could do with health conditions the athlete has also. So there are lots of issues here. The thing you brought up about calories and fat, most everybody knows, there's more calories, more than twice as many calories in a gram of fat as in a gram of carbohydrate, 9 versus 4. However, the issue is that fat is much more satisfying. When you eat fat, it decreases your appetite very quickly. So you're not hungry as often, and therefore you eat less. Whereas eating carbohydrate, especially high glycemic carbohydrate, starches and sugars, those things tend to stimulate appetite. And so you've eaten them, and a short period later you're hungry again because it's processed so quickly in your digestive tract that you feel the need to eat again, even though it's only been an hour since you ate the last time. And so that's one of the major differences. So over the course of the day, you wind up eating fewer calories, even though there's more calories per gram in fat than if you ate carbohydrate. So it's much more complex than just looking how many calories are in a gram of fat versus a gram of carbohydrate.
Right. So, but then the other end of it is this, and this is kind of where I get lost, is that suggesting that it's a good idea, it's actually recommended to take on high-intensity exercise because, I don't want to give away the goat here, but, the idea being that if you did high-intensity work more often, obviously enough, high-intensity work is going to tap into your sugar stores and you start, lending in that direction. I don't know that I'm ready to buy the notion that you become fat adapted and that, at 85% of your max heart rate or above your threshold, your body's still going to be burning fat as an energy source.
Yeah, that's the one thing we don't have research on yet. There's very, very limited research on how does a high-fat, low-carb diet affect anaerobic exercise performance when anaerobic. And we really don't have that information yet. We know that it works extremely well for very, very long, low-intensity aerobic-type exercise, such as ultramarathons. Those folks perform extremely well on a high-fat diet as opposed to a high-carb diet. But there's really no research on the other side of it yet to tell us what goes on when one is anaerobic. For example, in a bike race, like a road race, like a Tour de France-type event. So many of those events are determined by what happens on very, very short episodes that maybe only last 2 or 3 minutes, like on a climb or in a breakaway or in the wind or something like that. And consequently, we don't know what that means. Road cyclists tend not to do high fat. In fact, I don't know of any at the pro level of eating high fat. And we don't have any research on it to really tell us what that means either. So we're kind of left in limbo when it comes to that side of the equation, that type of exercise.
Well, going back to the fellow that I'm working with, one of the things that has been a challenge in this, the reason we met, is that he's a great athlete in the short, high-intensity Spartan racing. He's an obstacle racer. And, he beats everybody's butt when it comes to anything under about 8 miles worth of obstacle racing. But the world championships in that event is 13 miles. And he's 190 pounds. And he's probably, if I had a guess, I'd say he's probably close to 5% body fat. He's really lean, and he's a very strong athlete. However, when he's pushing, and by the way, for 190-pounder, he can run a 4:30 mile.
Right.
But the point being is that the intensity being what it is, it catches up with him about 10 miles deep, and he fades. So the conundrum, you know, and people have been pushing him towards this high fat thing. And I'm thinking, you know, I don't know. I don't think that's a situation at all. I think for a guy like that, with the intensity that he's throwing down, I don't think it's going to work. I think he probably needs to just find a better feeding strategy, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah, it's hard to say. There's so many variables that go into this. Just talking about what the athlete eats on a regular basis is, you know, his chronic diet can't always answer the question of what should the athlete do as far as making changes to that diet, and therefore we're going to correct whatever the problem may be in the race. That's not always the case. Sometimes it may get worse. But it certainly requires that the athlete and you, the coach, scratch your head a lot and come up with a plan of action to try to resolve this issue. And there's lots of ways to go. It could be that you've got the wrong type of carbohydrate that's being taken in during exercise or something else. I don't know what's going on with this athlete, so there could be a lot of variables.
Right. Okay, so a couple things about your book that I found really fascinating. One of them being the research that was conducted where they compared these Ironman athletes or triathletes in common at the elite level, where guys that got older and the whole thing. So you're finding that the guys that tend to race the shorter distances are fitter than the guys that tend to do the long stuff. Isn't that pretty much what you were saying there?
So, in essence,
it gets back to the intensity, right?
Yeah, exactly. Now, there was one that you're talking about, one study that came out that looked at a comparison of age group athletes in various categories compared with the overall winning time as far as like their splits for the race. And what they found was that for the shorter distance athletes, like Olympic distance triathletes, they finished at a higher percentage of the winner's performance than did the Ironman distance racers. As they got older, they seemed to slow down compared to the winner of the race much more dramatically than the Olympic distance runners did or athletes did. So it seems to imply, we don't know exactly, it seems to imply that by training for short distance events, you obviously are doing more high intensity training, and therefore you slow down less. It brings us right back to the discussion again of one of the things that causes the decline in performance of age is a loss of VO2 max. And we know that good high intensity training, like doing short races, improves that, whereas doing long, slow distances, like when you train for an Ironman, tends to compound the problem. So that seems to give support to the concept again.
Well, and then if you were to, you know, if you were to stand in front of a group of people that were 50 years old plus, and you were to say, okay, you know, we know you like to get out there and participate in these events, would you, based on what you're saying right now, suggest to them that for longevity's sake, to maintain their vigor, that it would be better to do the shorter distance events, like Olympic distance events, more often as opposed to gearing up and training for long type events like Ironman?
Well, if the people were, if I'm talking about here, I don't know who they are, but if they were novices, certainly there'd be no question about that. If they were experienced triathletes and I'm trying to make suggestions on what they should do going forward, a lot of Ironman distance athletes don't want to give up Ironman. They enjoy it with good reasons. It is challenging, and there's a lot to be said for trying to qualify, for example, for Kona. That's a major accomplishment at any age. So what I would tend to say to these people then is what we need to make sure we're doing is high intensity training throughout the year, regardless of the distance you're training for. So you need to include some high intensity training, even if you're training for Ironman distance races. And it needs to be done year-round. It can't just be done on a seasonal basis where you do it like in the winter only and then you forget about the rest of the year. It needs to be done year-round to maintain VO2 max. The question becomes, how do we fit that into a training schedule for an Ironman, for example, given the fact that that athlete has to do all this other training, long workouts, steady state workouts, hill work, swim, bike, and run. And how do we fit that in? So it becomes a problem of periodization more than anything else.
Right. Now, and I'm assuming that it doesn't really make that much difference what the modality is in order to get that high intensity dose. So, for example, if you were to get on like a Concept 2 rower and just hammer it out and do some intervals on that thing, you're looking at these cardiovascular benefits that are really going to make a big difference in your heart strength and, you know, your ejection fraction and all the things that are going to pump that VO2 up, right?
Right. Yeah, one of the biggest components of VO2 max is basically stroke volume, how much blood your heart pumps per beat. And the greater that is, typically the higher the VO2 max is. But there are other components that fit into it also. There are things that happen at the muscular level, like aerobic enzymes, that help produce the energy to drive you when you're at this high intensity. And that sort of thing has to be specific to the sport. So when you're working on certain components, like the cardiac component, you can basically use any sport you want. It drives the heart to a high level, heart rate to a high level. But when you're working on the stuff that has to do with, like, with aerobic enzymes, the stuff that takes place peripherally or at the muscle site, then we need to do activities that are specific to the sport.
Right. And I like, too, that you draw a lot of attention to the importance of aerobic threshold, not anaerobic threshold, because and I've been around this a long time myself, and I know that people tend to get a little confused. The water seems to get a little muddy when people start thinking in terms of training in and around their anaerobic threshold, where I think that you get to this place where you're not really arriving at the benefits that you're hoping for when you're scheduling what you consider to be an aerobic treatment. So I like how you're doing a lot of time trials, essentially getting to a place where you come to grips with what you're performing. I think you called it the efficiency factor, which I like,
right.
Where you do comparative analysis over time to see whether things are improving, and that kind of lends you in the direction you need to go in respect to what to do next, right?
Yeah, purpose of testing is to find out, for example, what your VO2 max output is. Output meaning how fast you can run when at VO2 max, or what your power is when you're at VO2 max on a bike, for example. But we need to find that occasionally to see how that's doing. That gives us feedback on the answer to the question, what is happening to my VO2 max as I get older? Well, we need to do baseline. We can do that in a field test. It doesn't cost anything to do it. Or you can go to a lab and they can test it for you and tell you a number, which basically tells you the same sort of thing, just from a different perspective. So we can do that periodically, and that'll cost you roughly $200 a whack to get that done. So we can do it either way, lactate threshold, or which is also called anaerobic threshold, and there's a number of other names that are kind of like the sort of the same point in the intensity scale. And that can be found out in the lab also, but we can do it in a field test. We can just do a longer exercise bout, and the book describes these field tests. So you can wind up knowing what your anaerobic threshold is and what your VO2 max output is, power and pace. And from that, you can see what's happening over the course of time.
Yeah, and so, again, what I like about what you do and what is well described in your book is the importance of these metrics and the having the comparative analysis. So a lot of people still to this day, which it slays me, but they shy away from monitoring their heart rate. And, you know, people kind of tell me, oh, you're the heart rate kind of guy. And I'm not really a heart rate guy. I need all the bits and pieces of the information I could possibly gather to make decisions moving forward. And as you very nicely have said many times, is that heart rate represents input. And, you know, in the case of a bike, power might represent output or yield, your running pace. But to build a training program around just outcome is not nearly as effective as knowing what it's costing you to do what you're doing, right?
Exactly right. You know, if you own a business, it's a manufacturing business, you're certainly interested in knowing, you want to know both things. You want to know, what does it cost me to produce my widgets? How many widgets can I produce? Those are two separate issues. but they're both very, very valuable pieces of information. It's the same thing with an athlete training for a competition. The athlete wants to know, what does it take to produce a high output? What's the cost of that high output? And the cost is in terms of energy. You've got a limited amount of energy. How much energy does it take? And so by doing some testing, we can find out the answer to those questions and figure out if we're making progress or not. That's the efficiency factor.
Right. And the field tests, I think, are critical along the way. I know that when I work with people, I tend to, for example, just, you know, making it simple, if we're training for a marathon, you know, we start out with an aerobic time trial just to see what the yield is relative to the cost. And then we work from there. And the time trials get longer. They could be more intense. But, they, you know, every time you have this comparative, you learn something. And I used to tell people, so, you know, if you get to time to race and you start talking to me about hope and you wish, then I feel like I failed you. If you're hoping, right, you should know, right? I mean,
yeah,
your training should have taught you what's going to happen going forward, right?
Yeah, you should know pretty much on a regular basis what kind of progress you're making. Whether it's at the very least, if it's positive progress or negative progress. But if you really get good at testing, for example, you really have it nailed down to numbers. You can talk about, well, my pace for running now is this than it used to be. 6 weeks ago, it was something slower, or my power is greater than it was 6 weeks ago, or whatever. So if you have things like that, numbers you can hang your hat on, then training becomes much more definitive. And so when you wind up going to an event, a race, you have a pretty good idea of what you should be able to achieve. It's not like it's something that's a mystery. We already know where you are because of all the testing we've done.
Well, but also the information in respect to feeding strategies. I mean, you start to know that you used to have this much energy put back in order to keep moving, and that cost starts to becomes less expensive over time. I would think if you get more aerobic at these greater intensities, the cost factor is going to go down, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the things, again, you could find out in the laboratory. You spend a couple $100 to find out the answer to that question every time you want to find out. You know, am I creating more output or more yield, as you called it, mm-hmm. or the cost of doing this? And they do that test in the labs all the time. And they can tell you exactly what the cost was to produce a given output. Or you can do a field test, and you can find out the same thing. It doesn't cost you anything.
Well,
you can do those.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was going to say I test people here and
yeah.
have forever. But the first thing I have them do after I've tested them is I have them do a field test.
Yeah.
Because you know, you want to be able to see what that performance relates to those numbers. And then,
exactly.
and then, you know, maybe you don't need to be back in the lab for a long time, because if you're staying on top of it, then you through this comparative analysis that you're conducting in the field, You're starting to learn what you can get away with, and you'll know. I mean, you won't know precisely, but you'll have a very strong understanding of what you're capable of getting away with or not.
Yeah, and the interesting thing is you'll discover that the body goes through, it's kind of like a ratchet. It doesn't go, it's not a straight line with performance improvement. It goes up for a while, then it goes down for a while, then it goes up for a while, then it goes down for a while. And this happens on an alternating basis. It may be, you know, I do that workout, this efficiency factor workout for myself. I do it a couple times a week.
Wow.
And I can see that it changes every time I do it, it's slightly different than before. It's a little bit higher or it's a little bit lower. But the general trend is that it's getting higher all the time. So you begin to learn many more things about your body by doing regular field tests. And certainly going to laboratories, one way, to a clinic is one way to find out the answer to those questions also. But it can't be done as regularly or frequently, rather, simply because of cost and the difficulty of setting the testing up and so forth.
So give me a prognosis of someone that, you know, is, I call it the come to Jesus meeting, you know, where you have this life episode where you realize that, you know, you need to do something. I mean, doctors are handing out this information all the time, but you know, you get to this point in your life where you realize that you know, I'm going to be in trouble if I don't start, you know, getting my butt out and doing something. And so I decide I want to start doing some racing. Kind of spill out. Let's try to create a scenario. Let's say I'm a 55-year-old guy. I've gained too much weight. My doctor says, you know, I'm at risk for diabetes if I don't do something. And so I need to get my butt out there. How would we kind of work our way into some intensities and try to gain our fitness back?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, there's only three things that an athlete can change in a workout. No matter what level the athlete is at, whether they're an Olympian, professional, endurance athlete, or they're just getting started, it's the same three things. And those things are frequency, how often you work out. Second is duration, or how long the workouts are. And third is intensity, or how hard the workouts are, how fast you're moving, for example, running or whatever it may be. For the novice athlete, the most important of those three is frequency. The most important thing is they've simply got to get out the door. They need to get outside and exercise in some way, frequently. If they keep missing workouts, they only get in one workout a week, 1 week, and two the next, and zero the next, they're just not going to make any progress, regardless of what they do with duration or regardless of what they do with intensity. So the most important thing for the novice is get out the door. Find the exercise that you enjoy doing and go do it. It doesn't matter about duration. It doesn't matter about intensity. In fact, those will both be low. And don't worry about it. Duration is going to be short. Frequency or intensity is going to be low. Just get out the door and exercise. For the intermediate athlete, let's say that means beyond 1 year. The athlete is now in the second or third year of their exercise program. Now duration becomes more important. So now we start thinking about, okay, well, can we go for a 45-minute run now? We used to do 20 and 30-minute runs. Now can I do a 45-minute run on a regular basis? Maybe I'll even build up to an hour here in a few more months. As we get to the advanced athlete who's been around the sport for more than 3 years, now intensity becomes the key issue to their performance. Unfortunately, that athlete still thinks it's duration. People simply refuse to give up on duration as being the most important element. They think they've got to do these long, slow-distance workouts to improve. And the key when you get to that level, to beyond 3 years, for example, of frequent workouts with good duration, is now the issue becomes intensity. Are you training at a hard enough effort to stimulate the body to change? And so it depends on who we're talking about again when it comes down to what's the most important thing to do in training.
Okay, so, but I'm assuming that there is a place where, you know, what I fear is this. I fear a guy would take the idea that, okay, I'm going to get out and I'm going to do something. But I'm going to take it easy because I haven't done anything for a while, which is prudent. But isn't there a time early enough on where we kind of inject some fashion of intense? Because intensity is relative, right? I mean, what's intense for me versus someone else is a completely different spiel, right? So I'm just thinking, yeah. Shouldn't he have in the back of his mind that he's got to push the envelope a little bit here and there? And I think I would think it's safe. I'd still think it's safe to push, even though they're deconditioned. Because I would think that, you know, this is going to kind of get deep, but you're going to know where I'm going with this, is that this whole thing with Noakes put out, this central governor theory, is that your brain's going to keep you from killing yourself. You're not likely to do something that's going to cause you to have an episode, where a lot of people think that if they start pushing on themselves that's dangerous. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I agree. There's nobody's going to die from doing this. Or if they do, it's extremely rare. I used to work with some novice athletes just getting started in the sport, and I would have them do intervals. But they weren't high intensity like I might have somebody who's been around the sport for 5 or 6 years do. They were simply, it's like running. I'd have the athlete go out and do a 20-minute run, and after about 7 or 8 minutes, they would just pick up the pace a little bit and run for a minute or so, a little bit faster than the warm-up, and then they would slow down and come to start walking. And maybe they'd walk for a minute, and then they'd go back to running at a little bit higher intensity again, but not going anaerobic, just running a little bit higher than what they normally do during the warm-up and cool-down. So they'd alternate this 1 minute higher intensity, 1 minute lower intensity, But the idea that I don't really care what the heart rate is, I don't care what their pace was, I don't care what their power was. All I want to know is that they're first of all, they're frequently getting out the door and exercising, and we're doing various types of things to stimulate their body. One of those things being intervals. So intervals can be done at any level. It's just an issue of how, what type of intervals do you do, and how intense are they?
Right. Well, I know I have people that actually I have a client that a female that I work with, and she's 70 herself, and she's under my charge. She's run a few marathons, ran one last year, Big Sur, and I have her doing some pretty crazy stuff, and she's gotten to a place where she's gotten away with it. You know, she actually seems to be impervious to soreness. She doesn't get sore anymore. And I think that's genetic, to be honest with you. But her brother, who I've also worked with a little bit, is completely different than she is. And I think he may be even a year or two older than she is. But he's really, really comfortable walking. He doesn't want, you know, I try to get him to jog a little bit. And I've done a VO2 on him, you know, just to find out what his threshold was. I wanted to see how safe it was to take him out and push on him a little bit. And I would run with him and try to get his heart rate up. And I had a plateau where I felt comfortable that anything beyond that was probably too much. And I would monitor his recovery before we'd start off onto another set in the intervals. He was doing pretty well with it. And I was monitoring his progress to see whether he was improving over time. But, you know, his notion of this visiting intensity, he just felt it wasn't for him. And I'm trying to convince him that, in fact, that's exactly what he should be doing. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on something like that. Do you think a guy that gets to that place where he's not been exercising, that he should try to encourage some improvements in intensity?
It depends on how well the athlete is coming along. The first thing, my greatest concern is frequency. Are they, if I'm trying to get them to exercise 3 times a week, are they doing that? Are they getting out to train 3 times a week? If they're doing that, and that's proving to be successful, now we might start talking about intensity. You know, well, let's do a little bit faster, or let's do a little bit longer, even duration sort of effort, so we can start playing the things. But if you haven't got the frequency thing going, there's not much reason to be talking about intensity with them. Missing 2 workouts a week and then doing 1 hard workout is just not going to get the job done. The key for that person is frequency. Get out the door frequently.
Okay. That's a good message. Well, I'll tell you, Joe, I loved your book. I think it's a good read for anyone that is already involved in sport and is interested in finding out a little bit more about how they tick and what they should be doing or not doing. And your programming is awesome. You know, it lends them to a very safe and effective competitive place for people that over, you know, and again, the title of the book is not exercising over 50, but being fast after 50. So you're looking for greater things, not just maintaining.
Right, exactly right.
So I think that's very encouraging. It's just the idea of even seeing something like that as the header of a book is good stuff, you know. Fast After 50 by Joe Frail. I highly recommend the book to anyone that is competing in triathlon, cycling, racing in any fashion, and is interested in greater things. Well, friends, it's time to bring another show to a close. Be sure and tune in to us next week. We've got a lot of great content in store for you. I want you to tell your friends to check us out. You can always find us on Facebook. Simply go search the Natural Running Network, drop us a message. I'd love to learn more about you and the things you do. And until then, you have an amazing day.